As many of you may have noticed and may have read in my recently published update, this podcast episode is a bit late, and neither of us have written very much recently due to the fact that we moved out of Chile, which had been my home for the last 6+ years. So this episode will start off by going over first why I ended up deciding to leave Chile, since a lot of people are completely unaware of how bad things have gotten there. And now some of you may be thinking, well, Chile is really, really far away from where I live, so good thing that the dystopian madness going on over there won't affect me. Well, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but Chile, since 1973, has been used as a testbed for both police state and neoliberal policies by the US and the UK and the West in general. And over the course of COVID, the UK government in particular has adopted policies like its 5-tier lockdown system from this 5-step lockdown system that was first tested out in Chile starting in around March or April of last year. So if anything, the situation going on now in Chile that we are about to describe to you in detail is likely to be rolled out, or its rollout will be attempted, in the West during this alleged third wave period that we've been hearing about recently that they keep saying is going to happen around June or July of this year. So we're going to start off talking about the drastic differences in how Chile's COVID situation and their policies are advertised abroad versus how things actually are on the ground. So, Johnny, coming from the UK and last year's lockdown over there, what were your impressions of the lockdown situation in Chile? And also, how was Chile advertised to you while you were in the UK by the press, and how did that compare with how things were actually playing out down there?
Well, thanks for having me today, Whitney. It was a real shock. I mean, when you're in a bad situation, a lockdown anyway, and you want to get out of one lockdown and go into another lockdown, you always like to think that the other place is going to be better off, is going to be easier to get by, there's going to be less strict rules. But in this case, it was kind of the opposite. But I knew what I was walking into, and it became clearer the closer I got to Chile, because first of all, the airports in the UK were all very, they didn't know what they were doing. They hadn't a clue about how to rework their businesses according to the models that they have to now, the legal and health codes that they now have to follow. So I was waiting often for people to go into back rooms with my passport and talk about me for like 10, 15 minutes before they come back out and ask me for another banal sort of arbitrary form that they have to fill out. So it was a lot of form filling out. Had to go round the mulberry bush, we would say in Britain. I had to go the scenic route round. So I got to fly to Germany and see how their airports were empty, and then got to fly to Brazil to see how their airports were empty, and then got to fly to Chile to see how their airports were empty. In the UK, in the Daily Mail, they were advertising Chile as still open and not affected by lockdowns. You should go to Chile. It's a really nice place to go on holiday, somewhere where you're not going to be affected by the same problems we have.
Oh, man.
And that was, yeah, well, that was a real doozy of a doozy. Yeah, it was terrible. By the time you got into Chile, you start to notice armed guards everywhere. And I mean, I had taken a long way around, so I had been traveling for about 24 hours by the time I got off the plane and into a wonky minibus and past all of the many lines of tables of people who checked the form you were given just 5 minutes ago, and then you go to the next table, someone else checks that same form, you go to the next thing, they want to look at that form and all of the rest of your forms. You go to pass to military guards who are standing next to people with clipboards who are also going to check your forms before you leave the airport. By the time I got out, I felt sick as a pig, which isn't good when it's military roadblocks checking your temperature and etc. All the way down the road. I mean, the stretch between where I was heading and where the airport was obviously it was in a lockdown like I've not seen over here. Military roadblocks is something that we don't have in Britain yet. it's obviously something that's on its way. And I'm sure it wasn't like that in Chile a year ago. But I my experience of it was going into somewhere which was a harsher, much harsher lockdown than the UK, and having to go through lots of scary big military men who were watching your every move and looking out for any symptoms that they could break open and use as a form of, I don't know, trying to uphold the COVID law.
Well, some of those checkpoints that you're talking about, you know, initially with the whole COVID situation, it was the police, which is like a federal police force in Chile. And so they're like, you know, local officers would be manning the checkpoints. But, by December, at least in the region where I lived, which is the ninth region of Chile, also called the La Araucanía, it became mostly military people with large guns doing these checkpoints between just like towns. Not even like big cities, really, to go between any sort of, you know, between any district. You had to basically show your papers, proof of residency, to be able to get in or out or back into, you know, the region you're moving out of. And you don't have the right paper, you get fined, you can get arrested. I mean, it's really nuts. And apparently not that, you know, long ago, I had a friend that was in Temuco, which is, you know, sort of a, I guess, the city of this particular region, saw a guy get arrested because he didn't have the right papers to prove residency or right of travel for a legitimate excuse for travel or whatever. He didn't have that, didn't meet the requirements of the military people there, and just got sent to prison, got arrested and sent off. So definitely a situation that hasn't really been seen in the West a lot. And surprisingly, when you look at press reports on Chile and COVID, to a large extent, it's in the past, it was criticism of the lockdown policies, but not the extreme militarization that was going on with this was not discussed. And more recently, Chile has actually been praised heavily for leading, being one of the world leaders in the amount of vaccine doses given out given out on a daily basis. So
with Chile in general, my experience of coming into Chile, when you're in a van and you're having to stop every 10 minutes to vomit out the door, and you're worried about avoiding military checkpoints and being tested for temperature when you're ill, it's not a good experience. There was a lot of a real sharp shock. I mean, it's nice when you get over to a place you've never been in the world and you get to see a few new sights. But I think it became very obvious from on arrival in Chile that things were a lot different over there than they were in the UK. Where in the UK, the people were still, abiding by the mask mandate. I'm not even sure if it was a mandate by the time I was leaving, but most people were wearing masks in shops. They were doing that sort of thing, but they were not wearing masks outside. And one of the things I saw really straight away in Chile was the amount of people who were in masks. And it was in all situations, including seeing people sunbathing in their masks, in the sea in their masks, in swimming pools in masks. I mean, it was an experience to see.
Right. Well, you know, Chile has a national mask mandate and they enforce that outside. And actually, you and I got stopped by the police because we weren't wearing masks, and we pretended like neither of us knew Spanish. And the lady basically made it clear that she was going to fine us if we didn't put them on. And we were outside. It wasn't particularly crowded in the area we were either. You know, and we were walking past a line of people that were eating outside on benches without masks on, right? So, I mean, it was just pretty ludicrous. But, you know, as has long been the situation with Chile's police force, yeah, they love enforcing whatever arbitrary edict they're allowed to enforce. And, you know, they really like to show people, the rule breakers, you know, who's in charge, so they never miss an opportunity to do that. But you know, what's really interesting, too, is that, you know, the Chilean population has really rolled over for a lot of these things that have been a lot more contentious in the West. So mask mandates being one of those. Really, no, there's never really been much national debate in Chile over whether or not to wear masks. I mean, it pretty much has been widely accepted by the population, the need to wear them outside, inside, in schools, have children wear them, you know, babies even wear them and all of that stuff. I mean, really not a lot of debate about it. Whereas, you know, in the US and the UK, it's a rather contentious debate. And at least in the UK, as far as I'm aware, you know, school children don't have to wear masks that are really young. And in Chile, they're attempting to enforce that.
It was a very, it was a very shocking experience to see how people had adapted so quickly to all of the rules to such an extreme level. But on the actual journey down from the airport, the driver who was taking me home was saying that Chilean people, you know, they're rule breakers and the like. They've got to be kept under control. And I think that was something that I saw over and over, that everybody thinks they're a naughty girl or boy in Chile, that they're all in trouble for some reason and they probably deserve it. So they seem like, I don't want to use this term derogatory, but like beaten dogs, that they've been beaten so many times before that they just accept things as soon as they're put into force.
Well, I mean, I would say that's, you know, based on my experience on Chile, definitely true for a lot of people that were adults or young adults during the imposition of the Pinochet dictatorship, which, for those that don't know, was a U.S.-backed military coup that took place on September 11th, 1973 in Chile. It resulted in the death of their democratically elected leader, Salvador Allende, and, of course, the Pinochet dictatorship, well known for its massive human rights violations, mass murder, kidnappings, you know, including the murder of some of the most loved Chilean songwriters and, you know, celebrities and things of that nature. And so, you know, that, of course, went on for decades with the U.S.'s full approval, at which point Chile was used as a testbed for the development of neoliberalism, really. And a lot of other policies would get beta tested there and later implemented in different countries like the U.S. or the U.K., or they would attempt to. And a lot of this was, it wasn't just, you know, police state policies. A lot of it was economic policies. You had basically Milton Friedman, Chileans educated by him at the University of Chicago were basically put in charge of the Pinochet era economy. They're known in Chile as the Chicago Boys, and they basically, you know, had free reign of what to do with Chile's economy, and, you know, basically formed the model of neoliberalism that was later imposed on various other nations following Western-backed regime change efforts. Of course, there's a long list of those, and I'm sure a lot of listeners are aware of that, so I don't really need to go into that. But basically, you know, you have a population live under that sort of dictatorship, and where people get, you know, disappeared and kidnapped and brutally tortured and murdered by the state. A lot of times the people that come out of that don't want to rock the boat at all. And you really see that in a big way with a particular faction of Chile's population age-wise. You know, the younger generation, I think, is definitely different in that sense, particularly those that came of age after the Pinochet era was over, you know, in the early 90s. But I think with the whole COVID situation, the information landscape in Chile is so much more controlled than the U.S., which I think is also in a way a testament to the power of independent media, which, you know, a scene of that like that in Chile, totally non-existent. So you have the younger population really going along with the narrative and believing it because there isn't any information available that sort of runs against that. A lot of it is like copy and pasted from, you know, U.S. independent media sources or U.K. independent media sources, but a lot of it actually isn't really of good quality and, you know, sort of shared on Facebook sometimes can be borderline QAnon stuff, which is pretty funny to see. But, you know, it basically has led to really, you know, a lack of resistance for these policies pretty much across the board in Chile in a way that it doesn't seem to be happening in the West.
There is a difference, definite striking difference between generations in Chile. I'd say the older people, you can tell, is a shadow of a previous genocide hanging over them. And the younger people are obviously so much different, but maybe you could describe them as naive, not for their own fault, but through the lack of information that they receive and the lack of education that they get, and lack of understanding of what Western societies look like, because I think they look up to Western societies so much, and they still haven't caught up with the reality of what it's like to be within a Western society where you're still have the same amount to eat, you still have the same level of housing, you still have all of those things as you do in a place like Chile. But you know, there's no real difference between being a slave in one country and being a slave in the other.
Right. Well, you know, especially this middle-aged generation in Chile that sort of came of age during the Pinochet era, you definitely see in a lot of cases this sort of worship of the United States and the West in general. But their idea of what the West is very different to what it actually is. They sort of have this idea that's been largely shaped by TV series and movies they've watched on Netflix, and they think that all Americans live that way and things like that, and have a very, like, rudimentary understanding of the actual issues that go on in these countries and the pitfalls of living in them, what U.S. empire does abroad in the U.S. military, among other things, you know, because they're getting a lot of their information, you know, from Hollywood or CNN Chile, you know, and avenues of information like that. You know, they're getting a very specific image of what the U.S. is that runs very counter to what, you know, the reality of the situation is. It's sort of like this, it's really a fantasy in a lot of ways. And of course, if you try and challenge that, it's kind of a jaw dropping for some of them. You know, back several years ago, I used to tutor, you know, some Chileans in English. And if I would like talk about, you know, certain things about the U.S. that they were unaware of, or issues of corruption in the government, for example, that were, you know, are well known among Americans, it was just totally wow for them. Like, they'd never knew that it was like that. And it's just kind of interesting to see. So I think, you know, given that Western governments all agree, you know, publicly on the COVID narrative and on lockdowns or whatever, you know, there hasn't really been a lot of debate among those circles in Chile, I think, because they're like, well, you know, the West is doing it, and this is how the West is responding, and so it's the same for us type of deal.
Going on to lockdowns in Chile, wow, that was more extreme than we had in Britain, and they were having in Britain at the same time. Lockdowns in Chile were, you're not allowed to leave your house except for twice a week with the permission from the police, and you only get to go out for 2 hours per time, and that will cover all of the things you need to do, shopping and to travel to the shop and to travel back, and by that time it's 2 hours is gone in no time, so you have no other option to do anything else. Lots of the services are just closed down. The shops, I mean, they will check your papers on shop doors. The supermarkets have armed guards on the doors. They got armed guards on the exit. They've got guards inside walking the aisles, and they've got less customers in there than they've got security guards on occasion. The idea that is something that keeps you safe, when you go by a school and you've got three police officers lining up the children outside the school so they can go to school in the morning, and is like three armed guards. I don't even know how that was helping anybody. What, you were going to shoot the kids if they ran into school too quickly or didn't keep a 2 meter distance?
Or don't show the right papers.
Yeah, I mean, why would you need armed guards to organize children? And it was like, you know, there's like 10, 11 children in the queue and three armed guards. It does not make any sense. There's no reason for it. No rhyme and reason. It's experiencing what Chile was like was very, you're seeing the actions of bureaucracy come out. the terrible faults that come from that sort of bureaucratic idea that we'll put blanket rules over everything. Where to stop traffic jams in Chile, they create traffic jams preemptively. And it seems like you're wondering which came first, you know, the traffic jam or the police. Well, it was the police and the cone guy who came first, you know. These guys did things in a very special way. They did things by the letter of the law, and they were uncompromising. And that comes out in their society. It's a really weird one because a lot of Chileans seem very cool and relaxed, but I think they're cool and relaxed in their own backyard and in their own house. They're not so cool and relaxed when they go out in public. They're very scared of what could happen or what problems could occur.
Well, I think, you know, that definitely was a change that began with the COVID crisis. Like, the amount of, like, fear and distrust expressed between people in public in Chile. In the town I was living in, it wasn't as bad before COVID. But as soon as, like, you know, the fear got ramped up, not just in Chile, but globally, it definitely changed and hasn't really gone back to normal, I guess you could say. But going back to the lockdown policy, it's worth explaining a little more detail in that, because as I sort of mentioned earlier, the UK's lockdown policy, the five-tier one that I think was introduced a couple months ago, like the end of last year, was based off of the Chile five-step lockdown strategy that's called Paso a Paso, that began months before it was rolled out in the UK. And what's interesting in both cases is that the two tiers or two steps that are closest to normalcy in lockdown, hardly any county or district ever gets assigned those. Really, it's the most severe lockdown, the second most severe lockdown, and the, you know, less restrictive version of lockdown are really where the vast majority of the country is at any given time. And that's how Chile has been as well. So step one is the most severe quarantine situation. Step two has that extreme quarantine situation imposed only on the weekends and holidays. Step three basically has most things are open, but there's restrictions on dining and the amounts of people involved in certain types of businesses, no public gatherings of a certain size and things of that nature. And then step four and step five allow those particular establishments and businesses to return to higher and higher percentages of occupancy and things like that. But like I said a little bit ago, steps four and five, no one's gotten step five in Chile ever. And I think there were a couple districts, maybe around Santiago, the capital of Chile, that at some point were in step four. But by and large, it's mostly just one through three. And currently, we in Chile, 14 million of Chile's 18 million inhabitants, which is close to 80% of the total population of Chile, are living in step one, the super extreme quarantine. And so the rules for that quarantine is that you're not allowed outside your house unless you have permission from the police. You have to get that permission from the police by choosing the right form to fill out based on your reasons for needing to leave and where you need to go on the virtual portal of the police website. And then you fill it out and you get this document you can download to your smartphone. Or have printed out for you and things like that. And you have to show this if they stop you on the street to show you have permission to be outside your home. So it's not just for going into supermarkets. It's literally a permission slip to leave the confines of your residence and be outside, except for this like hour between, I think, 7 and 8 a.m. where you are allowed to engage in exercise, but only at that time. And it's just really wild. So basically, as Johnny mentioned, these permission slips, the ones they generally give to most people, unless you're traveling for a funeral or you have to go to the hospital for a surgery or something like that, you know, are only for, you can only get two of them a week, and you can only, and they last 2 hours. So basically, you're only allowed out of your house 4 hours during the week to do essential purchases. And this includes grocery shopping, going to the pharmacy, buying anything else you would need in town, going to the post office, sending packages, like all of that stuff is included here, as well as going to any sort of government office. Like, you need to download a or sign a form or go to the notary or any of that stuff, all included in this. They're not separated at all. You can't get more time for having to do different stuff. It's not just for grocery shopping. It's for everything. So it's very restrictive and limiting. And of course, at most of these businesses, except really small local ones where the people are a little more relaxed, you have to show this police permission slip to even be allowed inside. And they have multiple guards on the entrances and exits to make sure people without the forms don't slip in somehow. And everyone's wearing their masks the right way, and everyone's orderly and single file and what have you. I mean, it's very dystopian. And I mean, it's really arbitrary. You know, they have like those machines to scan your temperature when you go inside, and you put your wrist up, or, you know, you go up to it, and it's a wildly different temperature every time, you know, just in the span of a couple seconds. It's a you know, clearly not about stopping the spread or any of that stuff, particularly now in Chile. It's always been about conditioning people to accept authoritarian overreaches they normally wouldn't accept, to condition people in Chile, in this case, to have armed guards everywhere and have them be a part of normal life and sort of have that be normal for school children and housewives going to buy ingredients for lunch at the grocery store. And, you know, anyone that travels to the, you know, the city 20 minutes down the road and all of this stuff. It's just really unsettling and amazing, honestly, that it hasn't gotten more attention outside of Chile, because even as far as Latin America goes, it just seems that Chile's has been really restrictive, but it's been treated as sort of, you know, a leading democracy in Latin America and all of this stuff. But really, the moves it's been making, you know, under the guise of combating COVID-19 are just pretty unreal.
People in the West have got a real cold, sharp shock coming to them if it is true and they do implement the measures that I saw in Chile, in UK or America. You are going to see what it's like to be denied to go to buy food when you can't afford to buy food for the week and you're buying food daily. This is a lot of people's lives. Also, I think there's a lot of selfishness that comes down to the ideas of lockdown being a reasonable option, because a lot of people don't understand. With those permission slips, you get to go out for 2 hours. So loads of people who live near the city, oh, that's wonderful, you get to go to the supermarket. But people who don't live near the city, they've got to spend 45 minutes commuting either way. And that means that they've only got the tiny limited amount of time to dash around the supermarket, get what they want, and get back to a bus or a train that gets them back, because that commuting, that time traveling, is part of the 2 hours you get on the permission slip.
Well, I mean, obviously this makes life for the average Chilean super stressful. And if you are a mother in Chile and your child is in childcare, all daycares have pretty much been closed since March 2020. The one that my daughter went to closed forever in June of last year. And so I was, you know, I had to take her to her babysitter's house during the day. And with these extreme lockdowns, you're only allowed out for that amount of time twice a week. I can't spend my whole weekly permissions in one day to get time, you know, permission to leave my house to drop off my daughter and then pick her up. Then, you know, just one day of childcare uses up my permissions to leave my residence all in one day, right? I mean, it's just totally out of control. So who can even get a babysitter and work from home in those situations? It's totally nuts. And at least in the West, I mean, I don't think it's been that intense in terms of restrictions on childcare. But in Chile, it really got to a point where they were trying to make it, I think, just impossible for people to, you know, work normally. And it's just, you know, just so insane in a way that I just haven't seen or at least seen reported about in other countries. I'm sure this is the case in some countries. But, you know, for example, I have a friend that lives in a town called Villarica. That's a small city. And, you know, her house is right next to a playground. She has a daughter that's the same age as my daughter, about 3 years old. And they were outside and had gone to the playground. In 2 minutes, swarmed by like 5 or 6 police officers, chided for not wearing masks and being outside their residences. They had to go inside immediately or there was going to be an arrest made. You know, you can't even have your kid alone on a playground. I mean, it's just so... you know, mental, and the impact of this on children in Chile has not even been given any lip service in the news at all. And at least, you know, in the US and the UK, you'll hear mentions of it, at least in mainstream media. Not that that really does anything about the damage being done, but at least they acknowledge it. In Chile, that hasn't happened at all. No one's even mentioned what's going on here. And a lot of, you know, Chilean families in Santiago, you know, the capital where most of the population of Chile actually lives, or any of the other, you know, cities of varying sizes throughout Chile, most kids and families live in apartments that they're not allowed to leave, that have very small green spaces, if they have them at all, especially in Santiago's case. And those kids have been literally locked inside their rooms like prisoners for a year, unable to access any sort of childcare, just, you know, online schooling for now. Some schools in Chile have started doing in-person classes, but it's, you know, the kids of pretty much every age, from what I understand, have to wear masks. And, you know, I mean, it's a mix of, for a lot of them, a mix of this, you know, online school stuff and regular stuff.
I think there's trade-offs in different countries, and they all seem to be made at the expense of the younger generation. And I'm probably more vocal on this when it comes down to COVID stuff, is that lockdown is mental, often physical, even sexual abuse against children. That's what it means. That's what it fundamentally comes down to, that you either leave children in a house with the people and perpetrators who are going to treat them extremely badly, or the other thing that you're doing at the same time is cutting them off from all social interaction. And anybody who has a child, who cares for a child, knows fully well that without social interaction, your child's behavior gets worse and worse and worse, because they need that. That's part of the process of growing up. And I think a lot of the lockdown measures are just, I can't see them as anything other than child abuse. If you're putting them on to children and it's having the mental effect, and it's causing, at one point they were saying it's 1 in 4 children in the UK were starting to have suicidal thoughts that were brought to them by the experience they had through lockdown. If that is a true figure, which I always think these figures are dumbed down to so that they don't have to question the narrative as much, but if those are true figures, it's devastating. It's devastating for the next generation. The problems we see are going to be really vast, and they're going to be harsh, and they're going to be in about 10 years' time that we really see the result of what lockdown now is doing. I was talking to someone I knew very well who had children, and I was saying, but you know, he's a guy in France, and he was very, oh, my children are back in school, everything's basically back to normal. But the thing that people don't understand in those situations, if your little town opens up a school, there's many, many more schools that can open. There's many communities who can't afford to change their companies, their businesses, their schools, their everything that runs at the moment. They can't afford to change it to fit the modern business model, which is about taking away probably 75% of your business and still maintaining a living, which is obviously an impossible feat for the majority of people. The whole idea that lockdown is doing better, more positive than it's doing negative, is, I think, just madness. It's some form of mass distortion of the truth. The truth is that young people will be the most heavily affected by this. And when in Mexico, got to see that young people and kids were regularly not allowed in the shops. That was something I didn't necessarily see in Chile, but maybe we didn't test it out that much. But the children had to wait outside while adults went into the shop. So this type of idea, you're not allowed to be in part of the society, even though you're at the lowest risk and you're most unlikely to spread and be transmissible, yeah. That makes no difference. We're going to discount you from society and we're going to take part of your life away. We're going to stop you going to school. We're going to stop you going to nurseries. We're going to stop you having normal social interactions. And we are going to literally destroy your mental psychosis is going to be all over the place. The most important times of development is when you're a kid. And we all know that any even minor stunt in that development causes major issues later on. And these aren't minor. What we're experiencing now is one of the most, it's happening globally. And it's really, there's so much focus on the young people.
That policy in Mexico is really crazy about not being able to take children of any age into a supermarket. It is insanely discriminatory against single mothers who, if they don't have someone to watch their kid, literally cannot go into a grocery store. If they don't have, I mean, there are a lot of cases where you have to, you know, when you're a single mom, you have to take your child with you somewhere because there's not childcare in that particular point in time when you have to go to the store. And in that case in Mexico, I mean, what do those women do? It's just, I mean, that's not even something that was a policy in Chile, which was something I found kind of surprising.
This is what I think about. It is trade-offs between countries because they couldn't do one with the other. But at some point, they're going to do exactly that. They're going to make a policy where you can only go out for 2 hours. You can't take your kids into your shop. You can't leave them outside. So you're stuck in a situation where you may as well not go out. And this is what they're trying to do. They're trying to make sure that you're not going to go out as much. It's all about keeping you home by introducing arbitrary rules all over the place, in my opinion anyway.
Well, in the case of Chile's lockdown system, I mean, it just comes across as so arbitrary because they have these not transparent guidelines for when they move a city or region through two different steps of their 5-step lockdown system. So, you know, every week and sometimes twice a week, I mean, it's variable, right? Because I think they just want to cultivate just like this feeling of instability in people's lives. They'll announce, okay, this community and this community move down to step one to the total quarantine. These, you know, 5 communities move to step two. These go from step three to step two. These go from step two to step three. And no one knows where when the change will come, when it will be announced, when it will go into effect. So no one can make any sort of long-term plans. It's just as soon as you're allowed to conduct your business, whether it's from Monday through Friday or in step three, you know, during certain hours over the course of the week, it's just really, you can't make any long-term plans.
It takes stability out of much of your life. It takes the ability to plan down the road completely. We had to live, I mean, sometimes in Chile, though, it's already hard. You have to, like, the power goes out sometimes. And you're not sure if you're going to get it back in the same night. So, I mean, it's like even when you do make plans, things are there to scupper it. So that on top is an extra pressure. It's not like it's something that's replaced previous pressures. The country is still left disheveled in many parts of the poorer areas especially, and the more remote areas are just being left behind by this by governments who are just carbon copies of failed Western governments, because that's what we see around these places. It tends to be the carbon copies of failed Western states.
Well, they're like viceroys of the Western states, and they're there to allow, you know, the Western-backed multinational corporations to exploit the resources of that particular you know, country. And
they
Chile
do a good
is certain
job.
Right. And Chile is certainly no exception to that. And one thing I did want to highlight too about what's going on in Chile that actually is going on parallel to COVID is this effort by the Chilean government to basically declare martial law in a specific region. The region I was living in, which is, as I said earlier, is called La Araucanía. It is called that because Araucanía refers to the Araucos, which is the Spanish name for the indigenous Mapuche people of Chile. And within Chile, the majority of the Mapuche population are in that region, or they live in the city of Santiago. So basically, this region that is heavily populated by the Mapuche, which have been in conflict with the Chilean state since its founding, basically, the Chilean government is attempting, and has been for several years, to declare martial law in this region because of what they claim to be Mapuche violence against certain communities. And there are instances where that has happened, but there are also instances where the Chilean police have basically committed acts of violence that were subsequently blamed on the Mapuches. And there have been cases where the police have been found out, where they were filmed setting fire to things that were later blamed on the Mapuches. And then publicly that narrative was used to promote and justify this need for martial law in the region, which of course results in the suspension of constitutional rights, and a lot of other things obviously come with that. And they tried to do this last year too, where they weaponized actually all the trucking unions of Chile, and did try to do a blockade. They did do a blockade of the region I was living in, which resulted in shortages in grocery stores. It wasn't super severe, but they threatened to make it more severe. And it was going to be worse until it came out that these supposedly furious truckers, furious over the Mapuche violence, supposedly Mapuche violence, were caught on camera, super drunk, running around with hookers and all this stuff on the highway, and not actually being and talking about how they had been paid to go on strike and all of this stuff, to justify publicly, you know, this declaration of martial law. Of course, when the public narrative fell apart, so too did that push. And this was all going on late last year. And then in February, a month ago, they resurrected it again and continued to push for that again because of another incident that the public narrative on that also fell apart, because it turned out that this murder that had allegedly been done by the Mapuche of a police officer, ex-police officer, I can't quite remember, had actually been committed by another person tied to the police forces. And this was exposed on national television by a former police captain, right? So obviously the most recent push for martial law sort of got hit again and didn't get to be declared as was being pushed by the Chilean government at the time. But it's definitely something they've been trying to do consistently, both before COVID and under the guise of, or why, you know, most of the population's distracted by COVID, trying to declare martial law in this particular region that I was living directly in. And that was definitely very unsettling, because basically, and this is my opinion based on my experience living there, the reason they want to declare, the real reason they want to declare martial law in that region is because they're having major issues with getting around Mapuche land laws that basically prevent land classified as indigenous land from changing hands from a Mapuche to a non-Mapuche. So, for example, if a Mapuche-owned property is found to have gold on it, for example, and the landowner wishes to sell that land to an international mining corporation, they cannot, because it has to go into the hands of another person who is a Mapuche. However, if you declare basically Mapuches to be terrorists, which is what they're essentially trying to do, and declare martial law in this region, then it's much easier to get around these indigenous land laws, because you can just seize the land. And you get to suspend people's rights to their private property and just their rights in general in that type of situation. And, you know, when I was living in this small mountain town in 2016, they actually discovered gold, in that in that area owned by a Mapuche, and were trying to the mayor of that town was trying to negotiate for some large company a way to get that land out of his hands and into the hands of this company that could then exploit that area. And it was unsuccessful, but this is something that they've been trying to do for a long time. And actually, you may have heard if you follow news about like alternative energy and sustainable energy, Chile has frequently been praised for wind energy and hydroelectric power and all of this stuff. But really, in the region I was living in, the Mapuche region, they were damming up all of these rivers, supposedly for hydroelectric power plants, but they were never connected to any city. And it's because they set them up there to power mines that they hope to put all through the mountains there, because of course the north of Chile is just all about mines and mining. It's the largest producer of copper in the world, and so the Andes farther south also has a lot of mineral wealth, but it hasn't been able to be exploited because of the Mapuche land laws, among other factors too, and environmental protections of the forest there and things like that. But I definitely think this is a way to get that area accessible to mining corporations. And, you know, the Mapuche community really stands in the way of that to a large degree. So there's a lot of things going on in that region in particular. Between, you know, that situation and the lockdown, it was just really not a good place to be raising a toddler. So, mm-hmm. you know, came to a difficult, very difficult decision to leave there. I'd lived there, you know, for 6 years of my life in that region, really specifically, pretty much the whole time. And, you know, it's all, become so different, in those 6 years, specifically in the last year. But I think a lot more people need to be aware of it because, you know, even though Chile is geographically far away, there is a historical precedent of the Western powers when they want to impose economic policy they know will be unpopular, or an authoritarian policy they know will be unpopular. They implement it and they test it out first in Chile and gauge public reaction on a much smaller scale, and then they export it and the lessons learned out to countries afterwards. And that definitely appears to be happening with COVID and other things going on.
Well, I know that there's a lot of people in my home country who would be completely and utterly shaking their heads right now and saying there's just no way they'd be able to stop me from going out. I'd just go out anyway. But once you're actually got fines that you're going to have to pay, then maybe you do think another way. However, I think we're in a lucky situation in the West that we've got the ability, even though it's often only a slight ability, to appeal things, to go to courts, to challenge things legally. And that was something that is obviously missing to a lot of Chilean people, because the difference, the gap, the wealth gap is obviously quite massive in Chile. Did you hear anything about fracking when you were in Chile? Like, were they getting into fracking as much as they've been doing in America and the UK?
Chile doesn't really sit over any, from what I understand, any natural gas that they could exploit. Though on the other side of the Andes in Argentina, they were doing some fracking projects in this area that I think was called Vaca Muerta. But I think a lot of that ended up getting shut down because of debts and stuff. But that involved a lot of the same multinational companies that are everywhere, you know, with fracking. But I think it was oil fracking, not natural gas. But
so it was goodbye Chile, hello Mexico for a brief amount of time. Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, not really. So a lot of people have talked about how Mexico is much more lax than other countries with coronavirus stuff, and you know, I think at the federal level, that is true. It's, you know, the only country right now in the Americas that you can get in without a PCR test, and you're not required to quarantine for any number of days upon arrival into Mexico. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there's no authoritarian abuses, or, you know, that it's COVID dystopia free. You know, as we mentioned a little bit ago, there is that pretty insane rule about the supermarkets. And, you know, there are a lot of people, you know, you're forced to wear masks in supermarkets and stuff. It's really not that different than some other places. And from what I understand, it's really varies on a city by city or region by region basis. You know, they're not all being enforced. You know, some places are more intense about COVID restrictions than others. But, you know, a big part of my dislike of Mexico is probably the weather, because I don't like tropical weather at all, which is part of why I was living in Chile, which is close to penguins in Antarctica, in cold places. so the climate wasn't for me, that was for sure, but I just definitely didn't, you know, I mean, I guess in some sense it was a little more free, but I think a lot of the being there, I kind of realized that the COVID dystopia that is being, you know, it's something that's global. And even if you go to a country thinking you're going to avoid it, you're not, you know, it's not something we can really run from anymore. And so I think at this point, at least my decision in terms of leaving Chile wasn't necessarily, oh, I want to go somewhere that doesn't any country that has, you know, less of this dystopia. It's more like, where can I go based on my personal ability to build a community somewhere where that community can then resist what is coming? Because I think in terms of like federal government stuff, you know, all the governments that have not been regime changed at this point are going to go along with the agenda to a certain extent. You know, in the case of Mexico, there are aspects of the agenda that they are happy to go along with. And a lot of the smart city stuff, you know, Chile, notably, is trying to be a leader in smart cities and 5G in all of Latin America, but they're followed very closely by Mexico. And Chile and Mexico, for example, both use Carbine 911, the pre-crime predictive policing, you know, software developed by Israeli military intelligence and funded by Peter Thiel and Jeffrey Epstein, that you may remember from my work. Mexico and Chile both widely use those systems. You know, it's not like the Mexican government is totally committed to sticking it to the elite or any of this stuff, you know, so we can't really fall into the illusions that, you know, type of leadership or whatever you want to call it is going to get, you know, save you or shield you entirely from the situation. I think that's increasingly going to come from, are you able to develop a resilient community that doesn't depend on the system to be able to weather the storm that's coming? And, you know, in my case, that's why, you know, or in our case, that's why we ended up coming to the United Kingdom after Chile, because it's certainly not the case that the United Kingdom government is not implementing extreme COVID dystopia. I mean, they definitely are to a huge degree. But, you know, in our situation, it's easier to develop that community here than it would be in other countries. And I think that's really, you know, what we have to remain focused on in terms of what's going on here is, you know, how can your family best weather the storm? It's all going to be local based. So, you know, where you have the most family and friend connections or connections to people that you can trust. You know, ties to resources that you will need to survive and things like that. You know, that's, I think, how we need to be thinking more than, oh, well, this national government isn't dystopian yet as all these other governments. Therefore, I should move there, even though I don't know anyone and I've never been there before and I don't speak the language or things like that, you know.
Well, soon I think it's going to be impossible to even go anywhere. They obviously, you saw the announcement that £5,000 fines would be given in the UK for people traveling abroad. So that's just a basic, you're naughty if you go abroad, and there's no way it's going to be within your pricing to be able to do it in the cost effective to be able to go on holiday nowadays into another country. Of course, they're going to make it so that every avenue you want to take to have a little bit of freedom is plugged up in some way, shape or form, and that is going to be more restrictive for people who think, oh, lockdowns are lifting, it's all right, you've been here before, you've got to not be naive about this. The future lockdowns, we will see harder lockdowns than we've seen before. If it's not at first, it will be eventually, because this has become now tried and tested, and people are sitting. It's like people reaching, like society reaches some sort of equilibrium when it's getting new rules are enforced upon it. So right now, these lockdown things, the first day were, oh, that's really hard to come to understanding. What, we're not allowed to leave them, we're not allowed to do this. But now people know the rules they're allowed to live by, and so they they're more likely to accept certain parts of them, and a express few they're going to dissent against. Eventually, the next time, those few will disappear until people will just acquiesce to the whole bundle, and the whole bundle is what you'll get. You'll get all parts of the negative laws from Mexico and the negative laws from Chile, because it's all about it coalescing and seeing what you push back on. A lot of this has been experimentation phase. At the same time, there's medical experimentation going on. There's mental, psychological experimentation going on all around the world. And it's very clear that not everybody's on exactly the same hymn sheet, but they're all singing the same song. In Mexico, I thought like the police were chilled compared to all of the rest of the places. The police were chilled, but you could see that the underlings of places were really quick to want to use COVID as an excuse for why they didn't have to do something, or why they could avoid giving the service out, or why you weren't allowed, why they were closing this restaurant or closing this bar. It's very easy for other people to use that narrative, and that again sets standards that become to a balance that eventually becomes normal. And we've got to be careful not to pick all of these things as normal at the end of this experience. We've got to remember that this way of living, societies in lockdown, etc., as being the first port of call especially, is insane, and it's going to change our society negatively in ways that you cannot even imagine yet.
Well, so to wrap up about Chile, another thing I wanted to bring up is the fact that you may have seen Chile in the news. I think I also mentioned this earlier, that Chile's been in the news because it is one of the world leaders in vaccine doses administered on a daily basis. And that's actually pretty interesting because basically this vaccine campaign success for the president of Chile, Sebastián Piñera, he at this time last year, his approval rating in Chile was 6%, ridiculously low, hugely unpopular, has remained unpopular for a very long time, and is basically, even though he's supposed to be in power, I think until 2022 or 2023, he's probably facing an election challenge anyway, just at the end of this year. But really, it's he's been rescued, at least in terms of the opinions of the Chilean press, by the success of the vaccination campaign, despite the fact that he's been widely criticized elsewhere, because of course the press justifies the continual extension of lockdowns and emergency state powers and all of this by saying that it's necessary because of how Piñera and his government manage the crisis up to that particular point, or what have you. With the case of vaccines, they've really just, given him glowing reviews and, how great, how proud we are to be Chilean because look at all the vaccines we're administering. We're a global leader in it and all of this stuff. Well, it's interesting when you take a look at the countries that are the global leaders in vaccination rates, aside from Chile. From the last time I looked at it, the top four are in this, in terms of this metric, are Israel, followed by the United Arab Emirates, then it's Chile, and then it's the United Kingdom. And what's particularly interesting about this is that most of these governments, not all, but most of them, have basically promoted the fact that their vaccination campaign success will allow them to reopen their economy faster, but not reopen the old economy, reopen a new, smarter economy and all of this stuff. And of course, we've seen in Israel's case that they've been at the forefront of the vaccine passport system in terms of that's passport's use domestically, not necessarily for international travel, instead using it, if you want to go to a bar or a gym or, a certain place of business, you have to show that you've been vaccinated, and things like that. And of course, the United Arab Emirates is also very focused on promoting, smart economy and smart cities, and all of this technology, looking to be a leader in that for the post-oil world, because of course their economy right now, not unlike Saudi Arabia, is largely dependent on oil and natural gas and things like that, that are said to be phased out and replaced with more with the energy sources of the fourth industrial revolution. and things like that. And so it's interesting then that you have those two countries, and then you have leading in vaccination rates, and then you have Chile right behind them. And what's interesting is that Chile has, in parallel with the vaccination campaign, also developed and started to roll a plan about basically making the entire country the first Latin American country to have 5G basically running throughout, you know, its territory. And the way they talk about it in relationship to the vaccination campaign is also pretty interesting, because they basically talk about how Chile is going to move to a smart economy. Currently, Santiago, the capital of Chile, is supposed to be the smartest city in Latin America already. They've made it very clear for years, including Piñera when he first came to power, this time anyway, in Chile, this presidential term of his, that he was going to make Chile a world leader, or a regional leader, in 5G, and in Santiago would, you know, adopt more smart city functionality more quickly. And one quote that came out pretty recently from the Chilean government was discussions of, if we implement and roll out this 5G infrastructure quickly, and we get everyone vaccinated, or a high percentage of the population vaccinated, we could even court Amazon, you know, the U.S.-based corporation, Jeff Bezos Corporation, to open a data center in the southern cone of South America, hopefully in Chile, and basically trying to court, you know, a lot of these big Silicon Valley tech firms, and get them to basically establish, you know, satellite smart cities, or test beds, or, you know, smart global infrastructure, whatever you want to call it, in Chile specifically. And they want Chile to be a regional leader in that. And of course, before them, you have Israel and the UAE, which are basically sort of working together to adopt that spot, that position within the Middle East, you know, as seen by their recent agreements because of the peace plan and all of this stuff, and the normalization publicly of relations between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. And then, of course, after Chile, you have the United Kingdom leading in daily vaccination rates. And, you know, the UK is also making pushes pretty similar to what Chile is trying to do, and Israel and the UAE are attempting as well.
Well, UK have a lot of bluster and bravado about their digital infrastructure strategies. For years, the debate in Britain over digital upgrades has been, is the internet going to get faster? Is the internet going to get faster, over and over again? And so the Conservatives originally put a big push into making sure everybody was up to high speed broadband, because in speeds, internet, average internet speeds in the UK, we're actually behind Romania, which is interesting. I'm not sure if it means that Romania is a high tech place, but I think it means that we've got very slow broadband and a very slow average, which we've experienced before. And they've been putting forward this drive to get up to a gigabyte. Everybody get up to a gigabyte instead of where they are right now. Recently, in their budget, in the Conservative budget, Rishi Sunak kind of dropped all of the promises to try and get the broadband speeds up, and instead seemed to talk more about digital infrastructure in general and changing over to digital society. But of course, anybody who knows you need fast internet to be able to enter into that digital society. And so the idea that they're not going to be fit in high speed fiber optic cable as much as they said they were going to do, and instead they seem to be producing papers like they did yesterday, which talk about looking much more into the effects of satellite and 5G technology in nature, might suggest that they're starting to think that maybe they could just use 5G and satellite technology for all communications in the future, and start to get slowly get rid of this idea of having technologies under the ground where they got to dig up pavements all of the time, etc. I mean, that's the benefit they put forward, but the negatives aren't put forward, because while they're talking about asking questions about the safety of 5G and satellite technology use in more rural areas, they're not even having that debate about the ones they're currently fitting in the city. So I can't see them as going too far on public policy debate, because when it comes to 5G, there is no public policy debate. They're not having a conversation about it. No one's allowed to have a conversation about it. And if you try, then you're a tower-burning thug rather than just trying to ask some questions that make sense. So I think that the government have cut down in this budget on their digital imaginations or machinations. They've decided instead, about the only digital thing they did in this budget was to raise the amount you can spend on the wireless cards in the supermarkets to £100 instead of £60 or whatever it is at the moment. And that was about as digital as the last budget got. Yet there was lots of rhetoric and talk around it, of course, as there always is. But there's lots of it seems to be more projects than there are starting than there are finishing in Britain. I'm not sure that there's much in the way of future thinking. There, a lot of it seems to be relying on foreign technology to do what they need to do.
Well, I think, you know, these four countries that happen to have the highest vaccination rates, I don't think it's about whether their ambitions will succeed. I think it's about their federal governments, their national governments, wanting and attempting to position their country to be a leader in a specific area or field that will be of increasing relevance to this whole Great Reset, Fourth Industrial Revolution as it develops and plays out. So, in the case of the UK, then, you know, there's a lot of important AI research for this whole agenda that goes on in the UK. One of the biggest AI companies that's currently owned by Google, called DeepMind, is based in the UK. You, of course, have Darktrace, the intelligence-linked cybersecurity firm with a CIA and MI5 guys on the board and all of this stuff. That are, you know, involved not just in the UK and their power grid, but, you know, the Vatican, US companies and corporations use them and things like that. And also, you know, the UK has talked about becoming a leader in quantum computing and all of this stuff. They've talked about making a UK equivalent of the US, the Pentagon's DARPA, for whatever reason, you know, changing their nuclear weapon stockpile laws and all of this stuff, saying that UK national security has become intimately linked with AI and all of this stuff. They're definitely making overtures that that's the agenda they want to pursue. And I think the UK government's policy, they're expecting it. These people, the people in power in the UK right now, are expecting the situation in terms of what, you know, how the public can make their dissatisfaction known. They're expecting a change on that front with their new policing bill and attempts to criminalize any protests that they deem an annoyance and things like that. So when they implement unpopular policies, they can just you know, repress them and not have to go through the motions they've had to up until this point, that there is a, you know, a free right to assemble in the country. Whether, I don't think they'll necessarily succeed in that, but I definitely think that's something that they're expecting to be able to discount in the months ahead.
Well, the police crime sentencing and courts bill 2021, which has been the reason for riots in Bristol, as mostly it's a very Tory police reform. Something you see when the Tories are in charge. Strong police, having stronger powers, longer sentences, harsher sentences, you know, all of the things that curry votes with the older folks, especially at a time when older folks are dying because of your policies. It's best to load those up. But the two lines that are really interesting in it was the strengthen police powers to tackle non-violent protests that have significant disruptive effect on the public public or on access to parliament. So that idea that any non-violent protest, and what they've done there is they've changed peaceful to non-violent so that they could target peaceful protests. They're rebranding peaceful protests as non-violent protests, and that means it's always one step away from the non being taken away, and it's always one step away from being a violent protest in people's minds. I think the wording of that is very interesting. And then the next change was to strengthen police powers to tackle unauthorized encampments where trespassers cause distress and misery on local communities and businesses. That affects so many different parts of protesting, especially for sites for travelers, etc., where they could basically stop you from gathering to protect a place or protest against the demolition of entire mini communities of travelers that have built up over time. So these target more than just those two things. Target more than just protesters. They target the ability to enact any form of protest. They take away peaceful protest as a right, which we all know what this is about. We all know we've got to stop being naive, that when they introduce bills like this, they may have a lot of things in there that you agree with. So some of the things for I don't agree with automatic half-term sentences, which I think is when they basically say, oh, you're a violent rapist, your sentence will be 15 years, but you'll automatically get out in 7.5 years. That's how the law works at the moment. And that was a lot of these things are really unpopular, and so it's easier to push the really unpopular things through when you're reverting some of the old laws back to the way they were before. This country, the UK in general, is on its way. Bristol is very much a windsock for the windy direction, with the direction of the wind, or it's a bellwether for the canary in the coal mine. Once you have violence and a riots break out in Bristol, you're 3 to 4 months away from having riots and violence breaking out in London. So we know that this end of this summer, probably August, September, we're likely to see London riots that we haven't seen in a fair few years. Probably 2011 will be as close as what they'll come to. But the more, this is why they need to open up for a short amount of time, because they know the time periods that people get really antsy. And they're going to have to lock down society again, because as they've said, they're soon they're going to have to start locking down society for environmental reasons, because you're killing the environment, of course, at home, you normal everyday people, not these companies polluting the oceans and putting all sorts of crap up into
the
military
skies. Polluting.
Or all of these main polluters that we have responsible for the state of the planet, but they want us to take the responsibility for that and feel culpable for all of the damage they've done, and say, you're not allowed to come out of your houses, so that we can continue to do that, and yet we meet our quotas on carbon taxes or carbon credits or all of the nonsense that they create so that they can make money.
Yeah, well, you know, the UK government's already really announced that they're going to lock down again for the supposed third wave. The last lockdown hasn't even really ended yet, and they're already saying they're going to do it again. And there's going to be a third wave in July. And it seems like there's a lot of events sort of coalescing around this June-July period. You know, you have like the Taliban in Afghanistan saying they're going to attack the West if Biden doesn't, you know, hold to the deal that was brokered under the Trump administration, and a couple other geopolitical events in the Middle East that are supposed to pop off during that time. You have major overtures towards some sort of war with the Iran on the horizon, in a lot of increase in tensions with China and Russia specifically, both, and it's not just in terms of rhetoric anymore, you know. So I think there is a push to lock down in the West, because there's going to be some wars maybe that get started, or some geopolitical tensions that reach really, you know, new heights. And it's worth pointing out that in the U.S.'s case, you know, the continuity of government protocols that they can, you know, the U.S. federal government can really implement whenever they feel like it to basically declare a police state and suspend the Constitution. In the 80s, examples of national emergencies that would warrant declaring continuity of government included major national opposition to U.S. military intervention or adventurism abroad, right? So, I mean, they definitely want stuff locked down when that stuff takes place, because they don't want to have to deal with domestic dissent with everything else they're trying to juggle in and act during this you know, really crazy and critical period of history.
I think one of the things we got to realize as well is part of the reason why they want to keep so many people indoors is there are so many reasons to protest at the moment. There are so many things that, like I said, we don't get a public policy debate with when it comes to 5G. That's the same with a lot of the rules around COVID, a lot of the lockdown rules. I think it's very interesting. The World Health Organization were the ones to say pretty early on in comparison to this whole event, in relation to this whole event, that lockdown shouldn't be used automatically as a tool to control viruses, and that they don't.
Or as the main tool.
Or as the main tool, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the fact is that they know legally that's going to be the thing that lands the people in hot water, and we're about to see a lot of the legal challenges come from what happened. They don't want people challenging legally or with protests in the street. They don't want people outside their house. They don't want people finding ways to make their voice heard. They're trying to take people's voices away at the moment. It's systematic, and it will continue until enough people say no more, and there is there are people who are going against the protest orders that are currently being put down to stop people actually having a right to a voice.
I think it's also important to point out that the reason these lockdowns, they plan to have them drag on for not just this year, but, you know, years to come. You know, that's why we saw The Guardian, like you mentioned a second ago, Johnny, talk about the need to do lockdowns every so often for climate change, so that, you know, now lockdowns are about climate change and not about COVID. Why is it, you know, why is the main justification for this extreme policy shifting like that? And why is that not weird to people? You know, well, it's because the lockdowns need to happen because there's a lot of infrastructure these governments need to put in place in order to be able to create the control systems in all these different sectors that they want to create. And a lot of that, of course, is based on AI. And it is my opinion that their AI, they thought at this point, once they, you know, got access to all this data and everything was virtual, you know, that their AI would advance a lot faster than it has, or would get to a point where it could be more autonomous and do control a lot of these systems in ways that it can't yet. And I think that, you know, they're going to try and keep things as locked down as possible until that point at which they feel comfortable about the extent of the infrastructure being installed. And so I think the fact that you're seeing a lot of these governments that are trying to lead on this now, making these detailed plans for rolling out that infrastructure in Chile, the UK, Israel, in the UAE, and some other places, you know, have made it just in the past couple months really clear what direction they're going to go, what infrastructure they're going to develop, and what it's for. I think we're going to see that on a bigger scale too, from you know, numerous other nations. But I think the fact that the nations that are trying to lead are just trying to start and roll this out is a really big indicator that they're, one, not ready yet. They need us, at least a certain percentage of the population, to continue to go along with lockdown. And that they're actually pretty vulnerable right now, in a sense, because they have, you know, this situation where people probably aren't going to easily go along with lockdown for very much longer, unless there's some big wild card event, whether COVID or otherwise, thrown in the mix. And but they have to keep it locked down till the AI is ready. And if the AI isn't advancing the way they want, and there's also the possibility too, that it may never get to the point they want, and the type of cognitive computing they want to develop is actually not actually possible to produce in a functional way, they're going to keep trying to drag this out, for as long as they need to have that infrastructure there. So I think that's really the main driver of what the lockdown policy is. And, you know, they're going to beta test again in Chile and some of these other countries how long it takes to roll those systems out in nations of this particular size. Because before they try and do it in a country like the U.S., for example, that's much larger than all the countries I was just talking about, both in terms of physical size and population size, you know, it's a much more ambitious project if you're going to gauge how you can roll it out and quash dissent to it and all of this stuff in smaller countries like Chile and Israel and the UK and all of that, then it's much easier to apply what you have learned from that to a larger country like the US, for example.
There's a lot to be said about them not actually being able to roll out all of these technological solutions. I think that eyes are way too big for their belly. Complacency and cockiness tends to be the downfall of these elites. But I also do think it's important to remember that, things like flight and electricity were awe-inspiring to the first people who experienced them. And AI to us is something that's new and is a new technology. There's always something that's even more technologically advanced coming afterwards. So we've got to be careful and open our eyes to what that may be. And these people, they may put all their eggs in one basket and discover they've just got a fail at the end of the day, that they haven't got the ability to create some sort of almost supernatural AI overlord, which will have every answer to every question that you can give. That idea is something that is very much a fairy tale. And these people are very childlike in the way that they chase that fairy tale, almost like it's eternal life.
Well, I think that is a great place to end it, because it really is important to underscore the point that, you know, it may look like a hopeless situation to a lot of people, but really what you have to understand is that this agenda, particularly right now, is very vulnerable. And there's a reason they're trying to make it illegal to use traditional avenues of expressing dissent. And we really need to start planning out really effective ways to resist that don't necessarily involve getting in the street and being physical with police officers. You know, basically, I think divesting from the system, the powers that be, whatever, particularly economically, like not paying taxes to these governments anymore and funding them, and things like that are really the way forward. And that's something, you know, you can be passive about. You don't have to get out in the street and necessarily get physical over it. But I think we really need to start planning that stuff out if you know, people haven't started already, because, you know, we are at a position where we can really start to affect change if we let go of the fear they've been trying to cultivate in the global population over the course of the year, if we can let go of that and realize that they're particularly vulnerable now, and that's why they're trying to set all of this up in this particular way. I think that is a really key point to end this podcast on. So for everyone listening, thanks for tuning in. Also, thank you for your patience as, you know, we make this big move out of Chile to another country and have been trying to get settled and all of that. We really appreciate that. And thanks a lot for your support and for listening.